Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast, today's adventure in live radio.
Yeah, and we even have breaking news. We have calling all the way from Ann Arbor, where I live, by the way. We have Jan Ness, who's the CEO of Online Tech, and you've done a deal, right, Jan?
Yeah, we did. We acquired a small operator with a couple data centers and a cloud presence in Kansas City.
Ah, okay. So another geographic expansion as well.
Yeah, it's going to give us a nice footprint in Missouri and the eastern end of the state of Kansas. We'll go from 5 data centers to 7 data centers, although the 2 we're picking up in Missouri are I would call them, they're commonly referred to as edge data centers. So they're kind of small, but they have a lot of compute, a lot of network gear so that they allow us to reach out to other geographies and pick up also a couple new disaster recovery products. We're pretty excited.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how far that footprint's going to extend. Does it go across the state of Missouri or just pretty much Kansas City metro area or exactly what?
So we'll probably focus on the lower half of the state of Missouri. Kansas City is a really nice community. It's one we think is underserved. And it reminds us a lot of Indianapolis, which we entered that market a few years ago and having some really great success there.
Okay, so what's the name of the company that you picked up?
Echo Cloud, ECHO Cloud, CLOUD.
Okay, and how long had they been around?
So Echo Cloud was formed about 5 or 6 years ago, mm-hmm. and it was started, it's kind of a sister company of ours. It was started at some common investors, let's just say, and so they started it and grew it nicely and got it to a point where it needed to go through a whole bunch of audits to get compliance with HIPAA and PCI. It needed to build out a software platform, which is what you need to be in this business these days to operate all your data centers and all your cloud infrastructure. And sort of, you know, when you're looking at making those really big investments, we've made those and we've been really successful with those. And we wanted to get into a new market, so it was like it was a win-win thing for us to do a transaction.
Great. And I'm assuming you're going to be sharing your disaster recovery as a service product with that new market.
Yeah, so we're going to take our entire cloud infrastructure, our what's called DRAS product, to Kansas City. But they also had a pretty neat DRAS product. That was based on some technology by a company called Actifio, which is, you know, one of these unicorn, really, really high-flying tech companies out of Boston. They've got a fantastic, just really unbelievable data management product. And Echo Cloud had been pretty successful with that. So we're going to bring that to our markets and then even beyond.
Okay.
So you're going to be asking, how many employees roughly at this company that you purchased?
There's only one employee actually that we're going to bring over. They had a couple others. There was about a dozen people at the company that were involved, but some of them have IT positions elsewhere. And we have an IT team. We have a NOC, so we're bringing over their channel person.
Okay, and that will be the person that'll be selling these products, right?
Yeah, they're going to do a couple things for us. He will be managing the partners that Echo Cloud, that's sort of how Echo Cloud went to market. They did not sell direct, right? So they were kind of like a wholesale provider. That's why they did what they did with mostly a group of IT people, a really good seasoned CEO in Bill Severin, and a person managing a channel that managed about a dozen companies that resold their products. And so that's probably one of the most strategic things for us is we now get a handful of new partners and we get somebody who knows how to build and manage that channel. So you'll be hearing more about us doing that.
Well, are there any other, are you sort of looking around? Are there any other potential acquisitions, mergers, or whatever out there for you guys in the future without naming anybody or anything like that? I mean, is that the way you're going to continue to grow?
That's not our primary source of growth. Right now, it's all about organic growth. But, you know, we've looked at a number of companies here in the Great Lakes state. Let's say we focus on tier two markets in the Great Lakes. And so think, Kansas City all the way up to maybe Rochester, New York, or Buffalo at least.
Wow.
And so we've looked at a number of companies. We've made some offers. We haven't pulled anything off. But mostly we're heads down making sure we know how to really effectively and efficiently sell these services.
Isn't your son in Buffalo or something?
My son's in Syracuse.
Syracuse. I know you had somewhere in New York there, upstate, you know?
It's a beautiful country up there. But tell me a little bit about, you say you're focused on organic growth. What's growing the fastest these days? Where do you see the biggest opportunities for the company?
Well, that's a good question. So, first of all, our fastest growing product right now, we didn't offer 30 months ago, which is this is about the third or fourth time this has happened since I bought Little Old Online Tech in 2003. It's our disaster recovery as a service product and our virtual private cloud, which is just a much more robust, compliant, full service version of something you might get from Amazon and Azure. And our fastest, what we're investing most aggressively in because what we believe will be the fastest growing segment of this industry is hybrid cloud. And that's where, you look at your collection of applications, you put some of them inside a data center, you put some of them in the cloud, you put some of them somewhere else in your own virtual private cloud. But you want one pane of glass, so to speak, or one bill, one throat to choke to manage all of that most efficiently. And that's what we're building out over the next year.
So I'm a little bit curious about the spaces that you occupy. I'm an old real estate guy at heart, I guess. I know when you put that one data center in Westland, the Metro Detroit one, you had a lot of extra room in there. And I'm just curious kind of how the technology is going. Are you filling up that space, or is the technology getting so much more efficient that you don't need as much space now?
Moore's Law kind of thing, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, there has been a shift, actually. What we've seen is that the people that would buy just like one rack, you've been in a data center and you see those black racks that you put gear into. There were companies that used to just buy one of those racks and they would put some hardware in there for maybe Microsoft Exchange or SharePoint and a phone system and a file server, a handful of things. And most people just go to Office 365 or Gmail or something. And so we're seeing those smaller data center customers go to the cloud. And fortunately, we saw that a couple of years ago, and we have a very robust cloud offering. So we've moved a lot of our colo customers, our small ones, to the cloud. But what also has happened at the same time is that corporate America, the ones that still have a lot of hardware, they've got to put it somewhere, and whether it's hospitals who want operating rooms, or there are big companies in Troy, for example, and you look around and they see 15,000 square feet of extremely expensive space being used to house computers instead of more people, and so they're getting rid of these things, and so we're seeing a really good growth, not in the single racks, but in people that want like a cage. They want like 100, 200, or 500 square foot cage to stick a bunch of gear in.
And that would become their de facto corporate data center that used to be on site, right?
Right. Right. I mean, really nobody should be managing a data center any more than they make their own power, right? I mean, very few companies make their own power, right?
Sure.
There's no value to that anymore.
I guess you could throw a few solar panels up on the roof or something, but
solar powered Michigan. Yeah, that would work. Other than that. For about half the year, maybe. So what else is going on? Well, we probably should hear. We just assume everybody knows everything about online tech. Why don't we talk a little bit more about what you guys do? We got some of that in there, but you've got five data centers, four in Michigan, and you got the big one in Indy. What else can we tell them?
Cloud is our big offering. Basically, You know, we work with a lot of CIOs and CFOs of mid-market companies. So, you know, two men in a truck-like companies. They're a little too small of a spend to get a lot of attention from the IBMs of the world. But they need somebody who has robust infrastructure. I mean, with our NOC, our security team, our network team, our 7 data centers, our 3 cloud pods, our disaster recovery, our security suite, it's about the equivalent infrastructure of a Fortune 500 company. And it's all available sitting here, no capital, on demand. You need something done. You need a certain configuration. You need it quickly. You need it to be fully supported. There's not a lot of places you can go for that. And we've gotten really good at delivering IT services, whether that's a stack of servers or some security services around your servers or a combination of all those things. As long as it's in our walls and something we manage, and we can do it really, really cost effectively, much more securely than most.
And you've got I lost my train of thought there for a second. Okay. I was thinking of two things at once.
I do that to a
I'm getting
people.
Old, you know. I mean, a senior moment. I know it was a good thought. It'll come back.
Well, speaking of senior moments, one of the things I always like to point out about online tech is that it was Michigan's very first private ISP, if you go back far enough.
That's
back in the days when it competed with companies with names like RustNet.
Yeah, that's Richard Steenan.
Yeah, right.
And Gary Baker.
Yeah, right, exactly.
All these people we know, you know, so...
Yeah. Yeah, it was the very first one.
We just celebrated our 23rd year on April 1st, a week and a half ago. So it's amazing this little company is becoming a bigger company. It's always going to be a great company. That's my job.
Well, and you've reinvented it 6 or 7 times. I think that's the key to survival this day and age.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Well, let's tell them how they can get more information. Yeah, and as CEO of Online Tech, give them URL for your website and who they should be calling, whether that's you or somebody else.
Sure. So come on by our website. It's www.onlinetech.com. There's all kinds of ways to reach us from there. We also have an awful lot of content, white papers, blog posts, on a number of interesting topics that are really useful for CIOs and senior IT people to communicate about the value of data and how to get the budget you guys need to better serve the services, the companies, I mean, the businesses that you're working at. So come on by there, www.onlinetech.com. And you'll see us there and sign up for a newsletter. We'd love to see how we can help.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much, Jan Ness, the CEO of Online Tech, Inc. And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast, the only internet podcast you are listening to right
we
now.
We hope. Yes.
Well, unless you might be
listening to more than one. Who knows?
You never know.
Yeah.
But we'll be right back in a minute with Mark Dreyer, a senior consultant at Red Level, who's going to talk to us about cybersecurity. For right now, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast.
it's Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Roush.
We're going to have such a fun time here today. So hopefully we're not going to butcher this one, but we did okay with the yon yes thing, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I think we handled it all right.
Yep.
And although I got in the promo, I screwed something up here, but we'll correct that now. This is, we have on the show from Red Level, Mark Dreyer, who is not a Mark Dreyer Sr., but is a senior consultant at Red Level.
That's right.
Got that right. Okay.
You got it.
Now, we can promote you some more. I'm sure that Janet's listening right now, maybe even Dave King. So what title would you like there? We'll give you another
how
one.
How high do you go beyond senior? Super
or
senior?
Something, yeah.
Graduate consultant? I'm not sure.
Yeah, yes. I don't know. Okay. But what's beyond senior, right? Yeah. You know, ultra.
Megamondo.
Megamondo consultant. Right. Yes. Okay.
So, but you, I understand that you conducted a session at the Microsoft Cybersecurity Summit. Where was that, by the way?
Microsoft's offices in Southfield.
Okay.
Yeah, they have a couple floors over there, and sometimes we get invited in.
Okay. And when was that?
Last Wednesday.
Okay. All right.
Oh, okay.
All right. So I guess we can cover the ground that you covered there. It sounds like pretty interesting stuff. It's all about network security, and I've been told you can keep your network secure with just a good firewall. What's the problem with that? Is that still true?
It's a little bit outdated of an approach. It helps, but it's not going to do everything. With every company wanting to enable their employees to be more mobile and get work done from any device, you really have to think about more than just securing your, data center or your HQ, whatever. You have to think about all those devices that people are using. Everybody works from an iPhone. Everybody works from an Android device. And, it's nice that people can work outside of the office, but that opens up a handful of security flaws or, vulnerabilities that not every company is comfortable with. And so that's why we kind of looked at some of those solutions last week.
Yeah, with that old BYOD bugaboo, where everybody has a smartphone and by gosh, they just want to plug it into the office. And maybe the kid played with it at home and went to some game site where it was loaded down with all sorts of crap, right? And then you get plugged into the office network and bad things can happen.
Absolutely. And, not even just the kids taking it, you could lose the device and, how much intellectual property could possibly be leaving with that. I've dropped my phone a couple times. I've dropped flash drives too many times. And, what happens with that data? You have to worry about, okay, is that encrypted? And one of the solutions kind of does, follow along the encryption path for some part. Some of it, as you mentioned, there's the BYOD, bring your own device approach, where, someone buys their own smartphone and says, hey, I want to.
Or tablet or whatever. Absolutely. Laptop,
Yeah. And so when people have that, they don't necessarily want to enroll it under some sort of, big brother type solution. So one of the solutions we looked at the other day was the ability to kind of partially enroll it, where you're only going to give the company the ability to work on, the apps that they're providing, the data that they're providing, and likewise only wipe that stuff if the device is lost, without, wiping all the other stuff, all the kid pictures, all the, vacation pictures, whatever apps people have on there, that stays intact if you do the bring your own device approach to it. And that doesn't mean that you couldn't still do a full mobile device management where, everything is locked down and secured. But it's a nice kind of in-between for those people who, kind of want to feel like they still have some flexibility and freedom with their device.
But sounds almost as if you're turning one of those devices or the personal tablet or laptop, it sounds almost as if you're doing a sort of a virtual, server with that, separating, separating one computer into a couple of different servers.
Yeah, it's very similar to that. It's, oftentimes you'll hear sandbox. Mm-hmm. So you'll have some of the company data, which is, kind of handled by policies, handled by, some settings that you can control as an administrator. Whereas if you, bring that phone home, give it to your kid and they want to install Pokemon Go, they can still do that and, go catch things without, causing any problems to the company data.
I used to let my daughter use my computer when she was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she
How'd that turn out?
Oh, God. And then when she'd leave, there'd be like 500 different kinds of viruses and malware and Trojans on the computer.
Yeah.
And I'd have to get it all straightened out before I could use it for anything. So, but she's a little older now, has her own computer, and good luck with that. So, app policies. What sort of app policies should companies do with when you're dealing with the BYOD issue.
Sure. So the specific app that we were talking about, or the solution, was Microsoft Intune. And that lets you actually secure certain apps. You can do a handful of Microsoft ones to start with, or you can actually, you know, kind of wrap your own apps with the solution. And some of the stuff that is restricted based on your policies are the ability to send and receive data from other apps. So, you know, maybe you'll say, all right, I like the idea of having OneDrive and Microsoft Word be able to communicate between each other, but I don't want maybe to sync contacts out of Outlook. So you could, you know, lock that stuff down. There's some functions such as stopping the ability to copy and paste. If you paste from an app that is protected into an app that you're not allowing it to, it'll say your company doesn't allow this. That's what pastes in.
Oh, okay. I like
yeah,
that.
It's kind of nice. And then some of the functions that they're kind of working on, at least for Android, is the ability to stop the you know, screenshots from applications. Mm-hmm. So they're really kind of saying, all right, what can we do? And obviously, depending on, you know, Android versus iOS, what APKs are made available, that will dictate, you know, what you can do in terms of locking it down further.
Yeah, you know, even when I get apps, I use an Android, by the way, from the Play Store, I'm still a little nervous about those apps, because a lot of those free ones, yeah, we're not really sure what's going on there. Are they harvesting your personal information, your GPS?
Oh, well, that's yeah. That's I was going to say. That's the one thing that I routinely deny is that you know I'm downloading a friggin' software app and it wants access to every file on my phone. I'm like, what does a software app need with everything I've ever looked at on this phone? You know, where are they trying to go with this? You know, well, so I mean, I wonder about that.
Yeah.
So yeah, deny that. Yeah, absolutely deny it. So you talk about. You know, maintaining control of apps, maintaining security over apps. It sounds like this is part of a broader policy. So what's part of a good app policy, you know, from a corporate perspective?
Sure. So you figure out what you can do to restrict things as much as possible while still allowing the employees to be able to do their job. You know, the thing about security is it's always convenience versus security. There's an in-between, and each company has to figure out what works best for them. When you have a company that relies heavily on mobile devices, for example, we do work with a large healthcare company that, you know, distributes tablets to all of their nurses in the field. They have a very, very strict policy on
how that's only for
that.
Company use, no personal stuff.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Yep. Makes so sense. They have very, very little that they can do to break out of the shell of what is company restricted. Mm-hmm. However, if you have, you know, maybe like I don't know, a social media company, right? Maybe their focus isn't as big on security, but they know that every employee has to be able to, you know, copy and paste from their email into Twitter because, let's face it, that's what they're doing. That's how they make money. So that might be a little bit less restrictive. And then you might have, you know, more traditional companies that are somewhere in the middle where they're just kind of coming up with the policies about, hey, we want to let people use smart devices to do some work on, but it's a new thing for that company. So they might approach it as, okay, we're going to put in a few restrictions, kind of pilot it, see how things go. And then, you know, once they get the feedback from the employees, they can kind of change that up and, you know, make
it
a little bit
stronger.
Well,
it used to be the road warriors carried BlackBerries because they were, all things considered, fairly secure.
Yeah, pretty locked down.
Yeah, right. And, of course, then I don't even think that company's around anymore, is it? I think it's
Research
gone.
In Motion. I'm not sure if it's
still around. Canadian company.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're not sure. They may be around, but I don't hear much
Let me
out
look.
Of them. Right? Yes. So would you? When you have road warriors, the sales types, the traveling executive, how do you deal with that?
Yeah. So I mean, think back to the BlackBerry days. I don't miss them, by the way. You know, BlackBerries were very, very secure. You did lock them down. You had the ability to wipe the device. That was cool back then. You know, you can treat salespeople like you do most companies that have people who are going to be mobile and, you know, try and get work done.
Mm-hmm.
You figure out what applications are indeed critical to their work, figure out what they need to do on those. If there are certain things such as copying and pasting data from some of those apps that you do or don't want to allow, then you make the decision there. So again, the idea of piloting and testing first is a great idea because you can kind of get a feel for, okay, are we being too restrictive or maybe should we tighten this up a little bit more? So, you know, maybe you deploy that to a small percentage of your company that's going to be using those policies in the future and get a feel for exactly, you know, what the perception is from those people.
Do you any I can do it here. I don't even have a beer or anything, you know?
Yeah.
Do you recommend any kind of particular hardware devices over others? I mean, obviously, your Apple shop. You're not an Apple shop. No. Excuse me. Wrong. Sorry, Janet. I didn't mean that. So Microsoft
Foster will fix
shop,
it in post. Yes.
So what would you recommend there? I mean, what hardware devices? Do you have anything particular, or is that really agnostic?
Well, I'm a bit of an Android guy, but a lot of people that I work with, including clients, tend to like iPhones.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them will work. Both of them can be controlled very well from, you know, I mentioned Microsoft Intune, mm-hmm. but a handful of solutions out there will take care of what you need in terms of securing it. You don't see as many people on Windows phones anymore, but yeah. There are ways to, you know, kind of control that. I don't recommend BlackBerries.
Are they still around?
They are still around. They are undergoing a restructuring. They lost $208 million last year on revenue of $1.7 billion.
That's not good.
So, yeah, well, that can't go on for very long, but I would imagine there's probably a whole bunch of restructuring charges in there. So that's one-time stuff.
One thing for the accountants to get involved and all that. They can make magic happen.
But they have an enterprise server product. They have an internet service product. They're still around. So,
but not that you guys don't recommend those guys then. That product.
It sounds like it's a really small market share, you know, type of product.
So. Yeah, I saw them, I don't know, maybe 3 to 5 years ago all the time. I don't remember the last time I've had to deal with securing one, and I'm very happy for that.
Real pain in the behind, huh?
Yeah.
That's a technical term, so. All right. So let's talk a little bit more about Red Level. I know the company really, really well, and I'm getting the two-finger sign here, which means we've got about 2 minutes left. So let's – we've got them all excited.
That's what we hope it means.
It's a peace sign. You know, okay. So we got them all excited. So how can they find out more?
Sure. So our website is redlevelnetworks.com, plural networks. You can kind of take a look at all the services that we offer. We kind of have a split of consulting. So if you need help with larger projects and you need someone who has expertise on them, we handle a lot of Microsoft solutions. We also do a lot of security hardware. And then we do have a managed services side too for, you know, basically outsourced help desk to, you know, not really outsourcing because we're in Michigan, outsourced local help desk.
Know you guys had that.
Oh, yeah. So if you call in because you need help with your printer, you're talking to someone in Novi, and we can
help probably
you
speak English, too, right?
I hope so.
Yeah. I mean, I hate it when you get switched to somebody with the accent so heavy. I'm not even sure what they're saying to me, you know? So.
Yeah, that's a sign of a bad English as a second language program. They need more of that. Okay, thanks very much. Mark Dreyer, he is a senior consultant at Red Level. I believe you're in Novi, right? The physical
that's
offices
correct.
Are? Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Brand new office.
And that's redlevelnetworks.com?
19,000 square feet, excuse me. Yeah.
Sounds good. Okay, well, thanks very much, Mark. And we will be right back in just a moment with Emily Heintz, the Associate Director of the Michigan Venture Capital Association, going to be giving us the mostly good news about the Michigan venture capital industry.
Yeah,
for right now,
good.
Yeah. For right now, this is Matt Rausch
and Mike Brennan,
and you're listening to the M Squared TechCast, proudly part of the PodcastDetroit.com network. Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast, proudly part of the...
I think it's catchy.
I'm not sure what it is.
Now is passed across the table to you. So,
good old fumble tongue here. Yep. Okay, all right. And we have with us now Emily Heintz, the Associate Director of the Michigan Venture Capital Association. That's an organization that I've been covering for a long time.
Long time.
Welcome, Emily.
Hello.
All right. I'm going to tell you my – I'll give you the Reader's Digest version of my Mary Kramer story, and then we can talk about the growth in the industry. I came to Detroit in 1990 as a finance writer at Crain's Detroit Business. I covered banking, accounting, and venture capital. And Mary Kramer one day brought to me in the early 90s a very nice-looking chart, you know, list. You know how Crain's loves to do lists. She brought me a list of venture capital firms in Chicago from Crain's Chicago Business. And she said, Matt, why don't we do a similar list like that in Detroit? And I said, well, the good thing about it, Mary, was that it wouldn't take up very much space. Because at that point, there might have been four or five companies involved in venture capital in the entire state of Michigan, in the early 90s. It was really a desert here. And that's the good thing about this report says that, we've now got more than 20, right?
Venture capital firms in the state. 30-something, 37?
33.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, it's even more than I thought. Well, that's the good news of this report, right? So tell us a little bit about, what you see as the highlights of the recently released 27 Michigan VC report.
Yeah, well, things are going great in Michigan. So we currently, as you said, have 33 venture capital firms investing in Michigan. And in the last year, $222 million was invested in 54 startup companies. And so now we are up to 141 venture-backed companies active, doing business and growing in Michigan. So it's been a really great year and some really great growth in the last 15 years, certainly since you were mentioning in 1990, there was not as much activity here.
Yes, one might call it a dearth of activity. But there's like $4 billion in venture activity under management currently in the state of Michigan right now, right? Something like that?
Correct. Yeah, the 33 venture firms have just over $4 billion under management that they're putting to work in Michigan.
Now, how does that, I mean, we always have to ask these questions. You probably have a handle on it. How does that compare to the other Great Lakes states? I'm assuming Illinois with Chicago would be number one, but beyond that, I don't really know how we stack up. Do you?
Yes. Yeah, so we actually do quite a bit of work with the other venture capital associations in the Great Lakes region. And the Great Lakes region is a place that has typically been underserved in the entrepreneurial community. And so we're seeing tremendous growth in a lot of the other states. Ohio recently started a venture capital association and has been seeing a lot of big successes. Wisconsin actually just started their venture capital association about 2 months ago. And we've been out there and have been working with their new venture capital association just to put together a research report. And they just launched another fund of funds. And then Illinois has been doing some really great work as well. So I would say that the entire Great Lakes region has been growing dramatically compared to national trends.
So let's talk just for a second about the different kinds of venture capital. I know there's pre-seed, seed. You know, go through the list and give me just a one or two sentence description of each type of capital. I'm setting you up for a follow-up.
We are this year really focused on making sure that we're looking at how much capital availability there is for companies at all stages, because when you have in pre-seed, when you see a lot of angel investors, companies that are just forming ideas and figuring out their market and figuring out how to develop prototypes of their products, you want to make sure that those companies are able to access the capital that they need to grow and then to develop those products and get them to market. And then when you're at seed stage and early stage and growth stage, that's typically where venture capital investors primarily invest. And that's when people are starting to sell their product and are scaling their companies and are growing. So those might be companies at the seed stage would be anywhere from 5 employees to the growth stage. They could be 300, 600 employees. And so we're really making sure that when their companies are, you know, starting up in their garages, that they're able to get the access to that early pre-seed stage, but then also continued funding throughout the stages as they grow, so we can make sure that we grow companies in Michigan that are able to get funding in Michigan and stay in Michigan long term.
Mm-hmm. And then the latest stage is my somewhat whimsical favorite, the mezzanine stage.
Which is right above the first floor,
ladies' lingerie, and okay. It's like a department store.
That's usually where companies are able to start getting bank financing, so they're cash flow positive and they're moving from where they get venture capital financing to where they can go to a bank and get a traditional loan.
Well, there's actually the very first round of investors are more euphemistically called friends and fools. So that's where you lean on your brother-in-law to help you out, but that's clearly long ways from venture capital.
Or you try to talk your dentist out of $100,000 or something like that.
Good luck with that. Yeah.
So, why are you trying to talk your dentist out of $100,000? I was like, I got to go to your dentist.
Yeah, right.
Well, I don't know. He drives a Porsche, so, geez.
That's the thing Matt and I have been covering this a long time. We understand the distinctions, but a lot of other people really don't. They, just assume right away they're going to leap into the market with this wonderful product and get millions of dollars from a venture capitalist. And I, tap them on the head and say, hello, no, that's not going to happen.
There's definitely a lot of work that goes into starting up a company, and Michigan is lucky to have a really robust network of entrepreneurial resource organizations to help people that navigate how to, develop their market and commercialize their product and get that first prototype put together. So.
And you guys on your website, I know I've seen it. We should probably link to it from my website. But you have all the venture capital firms listed there along with their sweet spots, because they all have different things they invest in. It's not like a monolithic, bring it to us, we'll take a look at it. They want to look at very specific things in most cases, right?
Yeah, definitely. We started doing the Michigan Entrepreneurial and Investment Landscape Guide about 2 years ago. And it was really because we were getting a lot of entrepreneurs coming to us saying, who should I go to that to invest in my IT app, or who should I go to invest in my consumer product that I'm developing? And we would be trying to navigate telling them, you could go to Ann Arbor Spark for this, or you could go to Tech Town for that, or you could go to the Michigan Economic Development Corporation and then talk to this angel investor or that venture capitalist. And so we started streamlining things, and we put together the landscape guide, which people can find on our website, and it has investment profiles and locations and contact information for all the angel groups in Michigan, venture capital firms that do business in Michigan, so even ones that aren't necessarily located here but spend a lot of time here, and then entrepreneurial resource organizations as well that they can go to just for advice, business accelerator services, things like that.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things about the report to me is looking at the sectors of the companies that get funded. It really shows Michigan's, legacy expertise in the life sciences. You've got a lot of former Upjohn and Park Davis people and former Pfizer people that are still around here, doing interesting things that are deal worthy, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we do have a very long history of life science investing and startups in Michigan, as well as a pretty good IT sector. But that's one thing that we've been focusing a little bit more on in the last couple of years is just the diversification of the economy that comes from having a strong entrepreneurial community, because you notice that Michigan historically has been very automotive focused. And when we have down economy, then everybody all of a sudden is like, oh, gosh, I wish we had diversified a little bit more beyond, just this major industry that we have in Michigan. And so I think when you have a really strong entrepreneurial community, you see a lot of diversity within the business community and a lot of opportunities that are open to different Michiganders as far as jobs go and as far as business partnerships go.
That being said, though, I thought one of the interesting things about the report also was that you said that 5% of the deals were in something called mobility, which plays off our legacy, but also I would imagine involves some kind of autonomous vehicle research, maybe? I mean, what were some of those companies?
Yeah, so we're starting to see a lot of We have really great engineering talent in Michigan and really great engineering talent in Michigan. And then we also have really great partnerships that can happen with all of the automotive companies in Michigan. And so I just had someone walk in.
Ah, okay. I can hear all the noise behind you there.
Yeah, so it's like been really great to see the IT sector in Michigan really tap into that talent and those companies, those partnerships, and then this emerging industry that we're seeing with autonomous vehicles, connected vehicles, apps to help with ride sharing. And so I think that's really a great way for Michigan to be able to utilize the strengths that we have in the state, but also branch out a little bit further.
Okay, we've got a little over 2 minutes left. I also wanted to let you talk a little bit about the part of the report where you said that 10 of the existing venture firms are currently raising funds. So where does a venture firm raise funds from?
Depending on the size of the venture capital firm, they might raise funds from a family office or a large angel investor, or they might raise funds from a foundation or a large institutional investor like that.
Or that rich dentist that Matt talked about, right?
Say that again?
Or that rich dentist that Matt talked about.
Yeah, exactly. Most rich dentists. Yeah, no, I mean, you will honestly see if there's a large family office that comes from a wealthy individual, they might dedicate a portion of their investment portfolio to investing in venture, as just like you would see with your own retirement account. You would put a portion in stocks, a portion in bonds, a portion in something else. So it's part of a diversifying someone's portfolio.
All right. So where do people go if they want more information on this report or the Michigan Venture Capital Association?
People can go to the Michigan Venture Capital Association website, which is michiganvca.org, and they can visit either our 2017 MVCA research report or our new Michigan Entrepreneurial and Investment Landscape Guide.
And hopefully you've got that video posted there, too. I shot Maureen Miller Brosden last week in video talking about these very topics.
Yes, we definitely did. We posted that on our Facebook page as well as our Twitter account. And so it was a great video.
Yeah, turned out well.
All right. Thanks very much, Emily Heintz, MVCA Associate Director. Once again, it's michiganvca.org. And for right now, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you've been listening to the M Squared TechCast. Thanks a lot, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
This is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast, proudly part of the PodcastDetroit.com network. We have now with us, I hope, a guest from my employer, Lawrence Technological University. That is our shameless plug bell. Whenever we plug our employers or something else that we're related to, we ring that here. Dr. Celan Arslan. Dr. Arslan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Matt.
Good. Hi. I wanted to talk to you today about the success of Blue Devil Motorsports, which is Lawrence Tech's racing teams. And yes. Some people may be wondering, what's this, a university with a racing team? But we have not one but five of them. So, Dr. Arslan, first of all, let's go through all of the SAE teams and what they do. And by the way, SAE is the Automotive Engineering Group, formerly known as the Society of Automotive Engineers.
Yes, I think they go with SAE International now. They don't use Society of Automotive Engineers anymore. What we have is actually, it's a part of the Lawrence Tech Engineering curriculum. So we are housed under Mechanical Engineering Department, and we have 5 Blue Devil Motorsports teams, like you said. And if I want to go in alphabetical order, the first one is SAE Aero Design. So it's not strictly just on-road vehicles. If you're interested in the aeronautical industry, then that's a perfect team for you. What they basically do is, the aero design team, they build, test, and fly a heavy lift radio controlled aircraft. And they have to carry a payload. And now this year, they're also using tennis balls as passengers. If you want to learn about their competition, what they're attending this year is they are going to Lakeland, Florida. And they are leaving in a week. It's in April 21st, between April 21st and April 23rd. And we have Baja SAE. Baja SAE is from the name you can tell, it's an off-road vehicle. And what they're testing is they're trying to see if they can survive through rough terrain. And they do testing like acceleration, suspension, maneuverability, endurance. And our Baja team this year is attending 2 competitions. And one of the competitions that they're attending is in Pittsburgh, Kansas. It's on May 25th. And they're going to Illinois in June 7th. So hopefully they'll improve their results by the second competition. We have Formula SAE, which actually we used to host the Formula competition on our campus. They used to compete in one of the parking lots. It started, I think, in 1979 as Mini Indy, and we have been competing in Formula competition over 20 years now. Hmm. And basically what they do is they design an open race car, like a Formula One style.
Yeah, it's like a half-scale Formula One car, right? Basically a half-size.
Yeah, it's very similar. I'm not going to say like half-scale, but they do design exactly like a Formula One car. And it's an open wheel race car, and they have to design and build. But one of the things that's special about the Formula SAE competition, it's not only a design and building it, but it's also a business case. So what they need to do is they have to do like a business case, a cost report, a design report. And so they have to sell that, okay, this is something that can be done as a hobby. And this is something that can be done less than $25,000. And one of the things that we're really proud of, last year we came 12th in our business case out of 130 teams.
Wow.
Internationally. So we were able to prove that this is a really good business case. It is kind of a marriage between design engineering, but also business. We have Formula Hybrid that's very, very similar to Formula SAE, but something very special about this is they have to do an internal combustion engine, but also electric motor, and they have to run full hybrid. And we came 2nd twice in a row internationally, again, like beating all the Ivy League universities and big tier one universities. So that's also something very proud of. And last but not least, we have the super mileage team, and the super mileage team is different than the other teams, because what they basically design on is how they can get most miles per gallon. And we used to have the team, and then we had like a 14-year stop, and then we reestablished the team in 2014. And the year that we reestablished the team, we got the Best Newcomer Award. And I think last year we were in the top 10 in SAE Super Mileage. And the other teams, we all travel, we all go to competitions. Our Formula SAE team is going to Brooklyn, Michigan on May 10th. Formula Hybrid is going to London, New Hampshire on May 1st. And our Super Mileage team attends 2 competitions. One of them is the Eccleshall Marathon, which is in Detroit in Cobo Center. It's on April 27th. And then they go to Marshall, Michigan on June 8th to attend the SAE Super Mileage competition.
This is Mike Brennan. Let me leap in and ask you. So you go through all these different teams out there, but what comes out the other side? Do these folks then go into the auto industry and they become auto engineers? I'm trying to get a feel for what comes out of the sausage machine here, as it were.
Well, first of all, they learn, I think, they learn to work as a team. They have leadership positions, so they learn how to manage the team. And in the end, our students that work on these teams, they have no problems finding jobs. They either go to the OEMs, or they can go to tier one suppliers. I'm the formula SAE advisor, and our students starting sophomore year, they have jobs. So they have no problem finding jobs, but it's basically an auto industry.
Hmm. Okay.
And
we have also, I'm sorry to interrupt,
no problem.
A few students that were part of the air design team. They ended up going to different universities to study aeronautical engineering as graduate students, like PhD students or master's students.
Hmm. Yeah, that was one of the experience of the aero design team last year, where their advisor tells me they had a serious crash on Thursday.
Oh, yeah.
Worked through the night, Thursday night and Friday night, to repair the thing, and then were actually able to carry a load on Saturday.
They learn to think on their feet. They have to come up with solutions really fast with minimum equipment that they have on hand. Yeah.
Yep. So I would imagine the advantage of these teams at a school like LTU is that underclassmen get more involved, right? Because we don't have 6,000 engineering students like they do at Michigan State.
Yes, very true. I think what happens is, in other universities, these teams are more like hobby or like outside curriculum teams. But these students take these as a class. It's like a part of a capstone project. They can do different capstone projects. So they can either start as a junior enrolled in classroom, but that doesn't prevent the freshman attending. So we have a lot of students right now. The team that's going to be officially formed next year, I have students that have been on the team since they were freshmen. So they can get their hands dirty, and they can involve as minimum or maximum possible since they're senior, till they're seniors. Once they become seniors, they take this as a part of their engineering curriculum in order to graduate, so they get a grade at the end too.
What percentage of all overall students would you say have participated on one of these teams at one point in their career? I mean, a third, a quarter, a fifth? Any idea?
At least 50%.
That many? No kidding.
Engineering students. Yeah.
Wow.
And I should also say that now on the formula team we have a robotics engineering student, and I know that on the hybrid team we have, I think, at least 4 or 5 electrical engineering students as well. So it's not only limited to mechanical engineering students.
Yeah, well, I would imagine.
I think on the hybrid, we also have a biomedical student next year. He's going to design their seats to make it as ergonomic as possible.
Oh, how nice.
Okay. Yeah, that's one of Lawrence Tech's faster growing programs is the biomedical engineering program. That's something that's been added, and relatively recently it became its own department this year.
Yeah, so it became its own department, yes. And I think one of the things the teams is a great example of theory and practice that we brag about at Lawrence Tech.
All right. So you went to a new engine on the Formula SAE car this year. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, of course. I took over the Formula SAE team last year, and we were having a lot of issues with our ECU and the engine. So our team, especially the powertrain subsystem, because we have different subsystems, they got together, they did a huge research on different engines, they did benchmarking at different universities. So we moved to a Yamaha 6-cylinder engine, and this is the first year that we're going to test it and that we're going to compete with this engine. We bought two engines. One of them is on the car right now, and one of them is on the engine dyno. So we were able to test it, and now we're driving our car and testing it on roads.
So what would be the normal application of this engine? Is it a motorcycle engine or something?
It's a motorcycle. It's a Yamaha motorcycle engine, yes.
Oh, okay. So its properties and whatnot are well understood, but it probably makes a car go pretty quick, I would think.
Yes, a little bitty race car. One of the things that you have to do on the formula, you have to restrict the airflow. So you cannot just work it. We have to put a restrictor that restricts the airflow, so you cannot go that fast.
Can't slap
so
a big,
really safe.
Can't slap a big Hemi in there or something like that, right? So,
yeah.
What would be about the fastest that the Formula SAE car would go in a competition?
I mean, in a competition, I think they don't go above 75 miles per hour, but without the restrictor, they can go above 100 miles per hour.
Mm. Oh, okay. That would get your attention in a small open-wheeled car, I would think.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You should stop by. We test our car on the parking lot. We block the parking lot. You should stop by and
I'd like to see a picture of Matt inside that driving one of those.
I'm pretty sure I wouldn't fit in there, and I'd be afraid I'd wreck
it. Okay, so in order to be able to drive the car, you have to pass the egress test, which is also one of the rules of the competition. So you have to be able to, you have to wear the whole driving suit.
Ooh,
and you have to be buckled in.
Pay money to see that.
Inside the car. And you should be able to jump out of the car in less than 5 seconds.
I think
if you want to do that, I'll bring the video camera over. And we'll shoot some video. Because people would enjoy that one.
I think I'd look like Chris Christie in that baseball uniform from last year, to tell you the truth. Yeah, that's one of the things I know that the Super Mileage team always talks about, is that they try to find the smallest person on the team who can drive the thing, because there you're going for, it's a little teeny engine, right, in the Super Mileage car?
The Super Mileage is even, it's like a lawnmower engine, so it's even smaller. But their focus is different. So they need minimum weight as possible on the team. So they need a lightweight driver, definitely, for sure.
Yeah, try to recruit a few horse jockeys to Lawrence Tech or something like that.
Yeah.
But they got, what was it? What did they get in the Eco Marathon last year? It was over 300 miles a gallon, right?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, yeah, that was.
I want to say 313, but I don't want to lie.
Yeah,
so.
And it was a little. It was
over 300.
It wasn't, and it wasn't quite that good in the official SAE competition in Marshall, I know, but they only got one run, and they thought they were going to get two, so they were a little disappointed.
Yes, I think you know, sometimes stuff happens when you're running a car, so unexpected problems happen, and you may not get the second run.
Yeah. And I know
I think as a new team, they're very successful.
And I know it's way off in the future, but every fall, Lawrence Tech does a fun event called the Grand Prix, where they have all of their SAE teams running their cars in the parking lot, and they invite other schools to come. And it's pretty much strictly for fun. That's usually in October. So I guess watch the LTU.edu website for that one. So
definitely. We do it around the homecoming.
Yep.
And we, last year, or this year, I should say, but it was in 2016, it was our 7th annual Grand Prix, and we had more than 10 visitors from Midwest and even Canada to come in. We compete. We, you know, we took their times and everything, but it's a friendly competition.
So getting back to these competitions, do the winners get scholarships, money, trophies? What do they get?
It's just for prestige.
Oh, okay.
Unfortunately, you don't get any money.
Damn.
It's just for prestige.
Oh, okay.
But I'm sure they get jobs, much better jobs.
Yeah, probably really good jobs too, right?
I know from my students, at least on the formula team, the minute that they put the formula on their resume, they say the conversation at the interview definitely goes there.
Hmm.
And I know my captain. He's going to start working. He's already an intern at one of the OEMs, but he found an amazing job. I'm very proud of him.
All right. Celan Arslan, you are assistant professor of mechanical engineering at Lawrence Technological University, talking about Blue Devil Motorsports. Dr. Arslan, if people want more information on this, there is a Blue Devil Motorsports website, correct?
Yes, we do have a Blue Devil Motorsports website. And they can go to that website and get more information. It's ltu.edu/motorsports/. So they can go to that website and get more information.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Arslan. I want to thank Dr. Arslan and all of our guests today on the TechCast. We had MVCA Associate Director Emily Heinz. We had Mark Dreyer, Senior Consultant at Red Level. And we had our old pal Jan Ness, CEO of Online Tech in Ann Arbor.
Breaking some news of an
acquisition. How about that? Well, listen, it's been another fun-filled week on your M Squared TechCast, proudly part of the Podcast Detroit.com network. For right now, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast.
Thanks for listening to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m. If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at podcastdetroit.com.